We have a number of visitors here this morning, and so if those of you who have been here the last few weeks will give me just a moment to kind of recap for those who are here for the first time today. We've been doing this series through the summer called Family Matters, and we've been looking at these family stories in the book of Genesis and kind of drawing out of them some common issues, family dynamics, things that I think are familiar to everybody. This week, we talk about this notion of sibling rivalry. Sibling rivalry. I don't know how many of you have siblings today, and some of you may be only children, or there may be such a distance between you and your sibling that you've never experienced that, but I think by the time we get to the end of this, we will all sort of know something that we could identify with in this notion of sibling rivalry and in and through this story of Jacob and Esau. I was reading this week about sibling rivalry, and I came across this article in the UK Daily Mail, and it quoted this author, Kim Doherty, who wrote a book, Sibling Rivalry, Seven Simple Solutions. Now, the book I didn't really read much of, but I thought it was interesting, her interview in this article, because she described her relationship with her sister, who's 4 years older. And Kim says that she can't hardly look her sister in the eye. I mean, when she goes to her house, she gets this sinking feeling in her stomach because of this sense of competition that she didn't even realize until years into it was there. You see, Kim's sister is beautiful, and she's married to this French husband who works this wonderful job and works a good enough job, in fact, that Kim can stay home in her very lavish home and be with her children full time. Who, by the way, those children are gorgeous also. Kim says that her sister's family is like when you go buy a picture frame and, you know, they have that stock photo of a family in it. That's probably her sister and the French husband and the two beautiful children in there. Kim, meanwhile, is so envious. Her sister seems to have everything that she wants in life. And she had this haunting quote in the article. Kim said, without even realizing it, my sister makes me feel like a failure. I don't know how many of you can identify with that. Maybe you've been Kim, maybe without even realizing it, you're the sister. I don't know. This morning we hear a story of two brothers, Jacob and Esau. Jacob is a quiet boy. He loves his mom. He stays inside mostly. He might have allergies for something outdoors. I don't know. Maybe that's why he has to stay in. But he's not much of an outdoorsman. His brother Esau, on the other hand, is a man's man. I mean, he's just one of these outdoorsmen and sportsmen. And, you know, he hunts game and he's close to his dad. And he likes to bring in the hunt. And, you know, they probably skin it and eat it and all that other good stuff. Two brothers are twins, by the way, so close in age and yet so far apart in personality. Jacob and Esau have a rivalry, we're told, even from the womb. They're in there wrestling with each other. Now, one thing that I think is really interesting that we should keep in mind is this. These stories from the book of Genesis, I mean, y'all realize they were not written down until centuries after everything took place. And so these stories, before they were written down, existed in the oral culture. And so imagine a group of people sitting around a campfire years and years after the fact. And it's late at night and they've had dinner and it's time, you know, they want a little entertainment before bed. And someone says, tell us the story about our great-great-grandfather Jacob and his brother Esau. And then they tell this story. Again, this was an oral tradition that handed these stories down for generations and generations. It's also important to note that the Bible as we know it is written, mostly, at least the Old Testament, by descendants of Jacob, who later would become Israel, the father of the people of Israel. In other words, we're kind of reading what would be the Fox News or the MSNBC version of this story, biased really hard towards Jacob. You could almost imagine this oral tradition. Esau's descendants, the Edomites, is who we're told were his descendants. Maybe they have a different version of the story they told around their campfire that never got written down. You know, they talk about the sissy younger brother, and he was a mama's boy, and maybe they tell the story a little differently. So our story, we go into it, it's a little slanted towards one brother already. It's good to know that, but I think it more importantly, it helps us realize this. No matter how the story turns out, one thing is true. Sibling rivalry has been a part of family life since the beginning of creation. Siblings have had a hard time getting along. We could go back even further in Genesis. I mean, the first murder, two brothers who couldn't get along, Cain and Abel. This notion of sibling rivalry is real. So a couple of things this morning on sibling rivalry. One is this: I think it's really great that we get to encounter this dysfunctional family dynamic in the book of Genesis. Because for starters, Genesis is not a book written of heroes that we need to aspire to be like. You don't look at these characters, at least I hope you don't as we get into these each week, and say, I want to be like so and so. These were broken people. They were flawed. They made some bad choices, even the good ones. We don't necessarily look to the characters in Genesis as heroes we want to be like. But maybe more powerful than that, we look at the characters in Genesis as reflections of us. Broken. Flawed. We make mistakes. And we see that they're just like us. And yet God is at work in their life. And maybe that's the powerful word, is that if God's at work in their life, then God's also at work in our lives, no matter how broken or flawed we might be on certain days of the week. God can work in anybody's life. This notion of the book of Genesis is really a powerful one. Another thing that I think is really important with sibling rivalry is this. For those of you who are sitting here, only children, or again, you know, like people with so much distance between siblings, you know, you never had that. You're probably thinking, I'm off the hook today. I'm not guilty of this one bit. Let me expand for you the notion of sibling rivalry, because it actually shows up in relationships beyond just blood relationships. Here's an example. You and a coworker go to school, same amount of time. You finish, you start a job around the same time. Same age, pretty much equals as you start the job. Have you ever secretly been jealous of that coworker if they got that raise or promotion before you? Or maybe you were the one that got it before them and they secretly resented you. Sure, around the water cooler, everything's good. You may go out to lunch and enjoy each other. Grab a drink after work, who knows? But deep down, you're also competing with that person. You know, we're equals and I'm going to get ahead of them. By the end of this 30 years or whatever it is of this job, I'm going to win. Whatever winning looks like. That's an example of sibling rivalry. You're essentially siblings in the workplace because you sort of start and are on equal footing together, which is what siblings tend to be. And healthy competition becomes an unhealthy resentment and envy over time. Or another relationship beyond the workplace. How many of us have those friends that we love dearly? We share the same age, same stage of life. We go to dinner with them, go to their house, they come to ours. Maybe go on vacation with them, who knows. Then all of a sudden, that friend gets that job that we always wanted. Or that friend gets to buy that house that we always wanted. Or that car that we always wanted. Or that second home that we always wanted. And here you have this relationship where there's this friend that you love, and yet secretly deep down, they want to share good news with you because that's what friends are for, right? And you hear the good news and you smile and you grit your teeth, and all of a sudden you're filled with this jealousy and resentment. This notion that, well, what did they do to deserve that? I work harder than them. I've done more good than them. And this friendship becomes something else. It becomes a rivalry. One that we probably never even say out loud, do we? But it's there. It's deep down. Has that ever happened to you? That's sibling rivalry, by the way. Equals, all of a sudden having this unspoken sense of competition with each other. So that their success all of a sudden feels like a failure to you. Because they got it and you didn't. Does that make sense? That's where sibling rivalry is all rooted in. The fact that somehow or another, someone else's success makes us feel like a failure. Or vice versa. So we come back to this term that I introduced last week. Many of you know this term already, but it's good to hear it again. It comes back to this term called self-differentiation. Friedman puts it this way: self-differentiation, the simplest definition of all, is this: understanding where I end and where you begin. So that our lives are not so intertangled that all of a sudden your stuff bleeds over on me. Your success is now becomes my failure. Self-differentiation is the ability to see my life as wholly separate from your life, so that I can then celebrate with you when good news happens. It doesn't hurt me personally when you get the raise or the promotion or buy the home or whatever it is, because you're different than me. We are differentiated from each other. But there's more to it. Hang with me here. There's two types of relationships. I emailed you this a few weeks ago. I'm reading The Anatomy of Peace. By the way, it's just an incredible book. I highly recommend it to everybody, because it deals with the nature of conflict in our lives, which is so present that we become used to it, almost immune to the fact that conflict is everywhere. And in The Anatomy of Peace, they say that there are two types of relationships: the I-it relationship and the I-thou relationship. An I-it relationship is where we see each other not as people, but as objects or obstacles. And you say, that's not true. That I have family and friends, I don't see them as objects. Yes, you do. And here's how I know that. Does my spouse fulfill my sense of happiness? Does my child make my day a little easier to get through, you know, without acting out and all of that? Do my parents affirm me so that I feel validated in life? Do my friends surround me with community so that I don't feel alone in the world? That's where we get in this gray area that, yes, they're people, but they're also objects for our own satisfaction, fulfillment, happiness, whatever it may be. And also obstacles. That argument with the spouse, with the friend, quite often we argue with them not because they're people we love, but because now this conflict has become a point of tension in our life and it's interrupting my day. I'd rather be doing something over here, but now I have to take time and settle this dispute with you. You ever been that way? Like you're arguing as you're just going out the door, and you'd give anything just to get out the door, get in the car, and go where you need to go. But now this person has this need that has come up that is creating an obstacle in your life. That's where we get into seeing each other as objects, the I-it relationship. Anatomy of Peace says that we need to think otherwise, which is what theologian Martin Buber says, the I-thou relationship, where we see each other as people, always. So that when there is conflict, which is part of, you know, human relationships, we're able to stop and not say, you're now getting in the way of my happiness in my day. We're able to stop and say, okay, let me hear you for what you have to say. Something is bothering you. Let me hear what that is. I honor you as a person. Therefore, I'm going to stop whatever I was wanting to do right now and listen. That's an I-thou relationship. I-thou, where we honor the sacredness and holiness of the other person. We say we love each other all the time. I mean, that's a common thing in relationships. But do we live as though that's true? That we honor someone else for the beautiful and amazing person of sacred worth that God made them to be. I-thou relationship. Here's the thing. Competition comes out of a sense of insecurity. We're insecure about ourselves. Insecurity is a symptom of fear. We're afraid that what we are is somehow not enough. We're afraid that somehow we're going to lose in this game of life. We're afraid. We're afraid. But God calls us to something more than a sense of fear. God made us in God's very image. God made us in love. God made us for love. That's exactly what you were made for. Before you accomplished anything in your life, got any ounce of education, before you did anything for yourself, you were loved by God. That's grace. Before you ever did anything to deserve it, God's love was there. And when we can start owning that and accepting that, I mean, it's humbling, right? But at the same time, it's magnificent. And then if we have the ability to self-differentiate, to see that that same love that we enjoy, that same sacredness is also found in another person, that sibling, that spouse, that friend, that co-worker, that parent, whoever it might be, then we can see each other for all of our beauty and holiness. And all of a sudden, competition kind of goes out the door. We don't need to compete out of fear. We can celebrate in love. Does that make sense? We can celebrate. Your success is not my failure. It's your success. I don't have to be afraid that just because you've gotten a success means that I won't get one now. Because with God, our inheritance is unlimited. It's grace. It's love. I want to leave you with this to finish. Brennan Manning is an author that I would recommend to any of you. His book, The Ragamuffin Gospel, it just was life-changing for me. I highly recommend you read that. Brennan Manning is a powerful figure. He's since died in recent years, but he influenced my faith in a very big way. Manning writes these incredibly beautiful, vulnerable books of faith. And it comes out of this vulnerability that Brennan Manning struggled with his alcoholism. Even after he had published many books and was older in life, he had a stint there at the end of his life. He had to go back to recovery because he fell off the wagon. But he writes out of this sense of vulnerability that recognizes how just how extravagant God's grace is. And Brennan Manning has this powerful quote. He says, "Jesus, the gentleness of Jesus is how Jesus can see the heart of people. How behind all of our grumpiness, how behind all of our anger and our fear and all of the conflict that we might cause, Jesus has a way of seeing our heart, which is the heart of a child. A child that hasn't been loved enough. A child that has stopped growing," Manning says, "because someone stopped believing in them." If that's how Jesus sees us, if that's how Jesus sees you in all of your brokenness, as a child worthy of love, shouldn't we see each other, or at least try to, in the same way? Shouldn't we try to see each other with the eyes of Jesus, not as competition or, you know, the enemy or someone we're going to beat, but as someone that we can share life with, that we can share love with, that we can share the inheritance that's unlimited that God provides us all? Thanks be to God. Amen.